welcome to The History of Philosophy in China by Peter Adamson and Karen Lai, brought to you with the support of the Philosophy Department at King's College London and the LMU in Munich, online at historyofphilosophy.net. Today's episode, Family Values, Confucian Role Ethics. People who don't know Chinese often make the vague assumption that the written characters originated as pictures of the things they represent. There's some truth to this, but only some. As an authoritative presentation of the Chinese writing system points out, writing in the proper sense was presumably invented precisely because of the limitations of pictograms, the sort of thing you might see on a prehistoric cave wall. For one thing, if you're trying to represent abstract concepts, then you won't get far with pictures. Also, early on in the development of Chinese writing, graphic elements were added for other reasons. There were cases where the same character had been used to express more than one meaning, so additional marks were used for disambiguation. Or a given character might be used to represent a second word with quite a different meaning. For example, even in modern Chinese, the character for flower is also used for the verb to spend money, because both are pronounced hua. So by the time of the Warring States period, when most of our philosophers were active, it was not possible simply to look at a character and know what it might mean as if it were a tiny drawing. However, it so happens that we can work out the meaning of the character xiang from its pictograph, which originally showed an old man leaning on a child for support. This word, which may be translated as filial piety or filial reverence, conveys something that should be familiar to all of us, trying to live up to our responsibilities we have to others. We can be all too aware of our role in our team at work when our promised document is sent out several days late, or we've let down a close friend when we haven't supported them as well as we could have during a difficult time in their relationship with their partner. The Confucian tradition in particular emphasizes the responsibilities we have to specific people, for example, the duty of a child to a parent to be filial. But we know that the term already played a significant role in early Chinese culture, since it is found in dozens of those inscriptions we have mentioned, made on bone, tortoiseshell, and the like. Some of the very early material incorporated into the one of the Confucian classics, the Book of Documents, also emphasizes filial reverence. One passage states that those who fail to respect their parents and siblings are even worse than criminals. The same attitude is encouraged by the Zhouzhuang, which, as we saw, is an ancient commentary on another Confucian classic, the Spring and Autumn Annals. Part of its moralizing project is to praise sons who showed great devotion to their parents, even dying in order to avoid defying them or bringing dishonor upon them. One such son, Ji Zi, is advised to flee the country rather than refuse a command from his father that will lead to his certain death. He replies, "Of what use is the son who rejects his father's command? If there were a domain without fathers, then I could flee there." And then duly he goes off to face death. Filial reverence was then a feature of Chinese intellectual culture before Kongzi came along, so it's no surprise that it is also emphasized in the Analects. But we do see something new here, the elevation of Xiao to a fundamental moral precept. At the very beginning of the Analects, we read that filial piety and respect for elders constitute the root of goodness. They say that charity begins at home, and the Confucian tradition agrees. While filial reverence does not exhaust our ethical responsibilities, learning to behave well within the family is the way that humans are introduced to proper ethical conduct. In the first instance, we are raised to respect and show devotion towards our parents and older siblings. Once this good foundation is laid, then we learn to have appropriate relationships with people outside the family. Ultimately, one acquires a more general benevolence, the virtue that the Confucians called Ren. Obviously, this doesn't mean treating everyone you meet as if they were your mother, and not just because you'd have to blow your annual salary on Mother's Day gifts, bringing a whole new significance to the fact that flowers and spending money are written the same in Chinese. Part of what it means to treat someone the right way is that you treat them in the way appropriate to the relationship you have with them. It would be too much to dote on an acquaintance the way you do on your parents, and even worse, to treat your parents like mere acquaintances. In another of the important classical texts of Confucianism, the Mengzi, five relationships in particular are identified as highly significant. There we read, "Between parents and children, there is affection. Between ruler and minister, rightness. Between husband and wife, separate functions. Between older and younger, proper order. And between friends, faithfulness." A man who observes the right degree of reverence, devotion, loyalty, and respect in all five relationships, being a good son, subject, husband, brother, and friend, is, if not a fully accomplished moral exemplar, then at least well on the way to being one. Of course, a woman can and should try to realize similar goals. We'll come back to that. But we do have to acknowledge that this ethic of relationships was intimately connected to the exclusively male world of political action. That passage from the beginning of the Analects continues by observing that children who respect their elders do not grow up to foment rebellion. Later on in the work, we encounter an aphorism that invites us to see a close parallel between good political relations and good family relations. Let the Lord be a good Lord, the ministers true ministers, the fathers true fathers, and the sons true sons. This may strike us as strange, since we nowadays tend to assume a contrast between the private and public spheres. But it isn't implausible to believe that well-raised children become good citizens, or that it is in the family that we first acquire a moral sensibility that could serve us well in political life. It's an intuition whose force is felt when we turn against politicians who are revealed to have cheated on a spouse or betrayed their parents. The early Confucians seem to have felt the intuition especially strongly. For them, the private and public spheres, or family and political life, were not just continuous, but in some sense, the same. We can see this from a passage in the Analects that deals with a potential embarrassment we've mentioned before, Kongzi's failure to have long-lasting influence as a minister. In this anecdote, he's told that some are asking why he is not participating in government. By way of a response, he quotes the Book of Documents to the effect that by exhibiting filial reverence, one is already exerting an influence on those who govern. He then adds, "Thus, in being a filial son and good brother, one is already taking part in government. What need is there then to speak of participating in government?" The responsibilities people have within their families, or as a co-worker reporting to a superior, need to be clarified. What does it mean to be a true or good father? Confucian philosophers developed a way of understanding our responsibilities. This was a process by which certain behaviors are taken as the norm, as for example that a father should earn an income so that his children's well-being can be assured. In Confucian philosophy, these behavioral norms associated with particular roles should be understood and practiced by everyone who is placed in those roles. This process is called zengming, which is often translated as correcting or rectifying names. The names are the designations that are held by people, such as father, son, or exemplary person. Although rectifying names sounds as if we need to alter these designations, there are in fact two components involved, the name and the behaviors associated with the name. A name is taken as prescribing a set of behaviors appropriate to what it designates. Therefore, a person who bears that designation is expected to live up to it. An important aspect of this practice of rectifying names is that promotion of these norms of behavior contributes to a society's cohesiveness. All share in an understanding of what fatherly conduct should be, so that anyone can call out behaviors that transgress those norms. This is what it means for Kongzi in the Analects to say, "Let the Lord be a true Lord, the ministers true ministers," and so on. And we too have our understanding of norms of behavior that are incorporated into our designations. For example, if a friend is unnecessarily fussy or bossy in their advice to another who's about to set on their travels, we might say, as an observer, that the traveler has two mothers. This joke suggests that we have an implicit understanding of the behaviors appropriate to mothering. For the Confucians, the responsibility of establishing the right kinds of behaviors associated with each name is a project for rulers. Thus, in assessing the central place of relationships in Confucian moral theory, we should bear in mind that this is a political idea, no less than an ethical one. Nonetheless, modern-day scholars have taken to calling the whole approach role ethics, the point being that our ethical goals and responsibilities are inextricably bound to the roles we play. European ethical theories, it has been argued, treat people primarily as autonomous individuals with rights and moral responsibilities that belong to them just by virtue of their humanity. Here we might think of Kant's ethical theory, which linked moral duties to the mere fact of being rational, or of the utilitarians, who proposed that each individual should do whatever would maximize benefit or utility for the largest number of other individuals. Especially in that case, you can see how different the theory is from Confucianism. It's a standard problem for utilitarians to explain why we should put any more weight on the interests of close family members than we do on the interests of total strangers. Role ethics, by contrast, begins from assuming the fundamental rightness of such priorities. As we'll see in a later episode, the same issue emerged in classical China when the Moists were accused of undercutting preferential treatment of family members with their own broadly consequentialist ethic. On the European side of the story, even Aristotelian virtue ethics, which as we'll also be seeing is often compared to Confucian ethics, focuses on the excellence of the individual moral agent. Very different is Confucian role ethics, and all the better for it. Or so at least have argued contemporary proponents like Henry Rosemont Jr. and Roger T. Ames. As they write, the Confucian position is appealing precisely because it sees humans as flesh and blood role bearers, rather than potential candidates to be abstract rights holders. It is a mistake to conceive of each person as being firstly an individual who only then enters into given relationships. That might make some sense in the case of friendships, since we do decide whom to befriend, but no one gets to choose who their parents or siblings are. In ancient China, and indeed in most societies historically speaking, individuals also had very little say in who they would marry and who would rule over them. Rather than seeing this as a problem, Rosemont and Ames suggest that good relations within the family are a paradigm to be applied in other areas of life. You simply find yourself being the child of the people who happen to be your parents, yet you still owe them deference, affection, and respect. That's excellent practice for cultivating the right attitude to take towards other people in your life, whether they are other loved ones, friends, co-workers, fellow citizens, or political rulers. Which again means that your attitude should be appropriate in each case. This idea was sometimes expressed through a comparison to the parts of the body. The father and son are like head and feet, brothers are like two limbs, and so on. Just as it's the duty of the feet to hold up the whole body, and of the head to rule that body, it's the duty of the children to support the family while the father rules over it. The type of relationship defines the correct behavior and attitude. It's for this reason that it would be wrong to treat a passing acquaintance with the profound respect due your parents, or vice versa. Here, a critic might ask, why? Why exactly do your parents deserve respect from you, of a particular kind and degree that is not found anywhere else in your moral life? This question is especially pressing given the demanding expectations the Confucians connected with filial reverence. We've already mentioned the stories about people laying down their lives out of filial reverence, and along the same lines, there's a passage in the Book of Odes in which a poet effuses about all that his parents have done for him and then exclaims, "The kindness I would repay is boundless as the heavens." This phrasing suggests that filial reverence is ultimately transactional. Your parents have given you so much that you can never really make good the debt, but you should still do your level best to try. But there's good reason to doubt this. The "I'll wash your back because you washed mine when I was a baby" interpretation would not account for the emphasis placed on the inner feeling of affection and devotion children should have toward their parents. Filial reverence really is a kind of reverence, so seeing to one's responsibilities as a good son, but doing it grudgingly, is not enough. This is evident from one of the Analects' most famous passages about the concept. The master said, "Nowadays, filial means simply being able to provide one's parents with nourishment, but even dogs and horses are provided with nourishment. If you are not respectful, wherein lies the difference?" Even such things as posture and tone of voice in the presence of one's parents would be part of filial reverence, not because they are part of a repayment for services rendered, but because they express a sincere inner feeling that is appropriate to the relationship. With this in mind, we can now better understand that story about Zai Wo, who ran afoul of Kongzi for mourning his parents for only 1 rather than 3 years. As we've seen, Zai Wo was deemed to be lacking in goodness, not just because he mourned for too short a time, but even more fundamentally, because he wanted to mourn for a shorter time. This showed that he had failed to internalize the propriety specific to the son-parent relationship. The demand for appropriate inner feelings could also explain why Kongzi didn't try to talk him into observing a longer period of mourning. 2 more years of mourning would not be a true expression of reverence if they were insincere. Another problem with the transactional view is that it would make filial reverence conditional on having parents who actually do care affectionately for their children. But the Confucians do not recognize such a requirement. To the contrary, they sometimes invite us to admire sons who show great reverence towards parents who clearly haven't earned it. Some of the men who die for their parents in the Spring and Autumn Annals do so despite the fact that the parents have done them great wrong. The Analects refers to the problem explicitly in the following passage. The Duke of Shu said to Kongzi, "Among my people there is one we call Upright Gong. When his father stole a sheep, he reported him to the authorities." Kongzi replied, "Among my people, those who we consider upright are different from this. Fathers cover up for their sons, and sons cover up for their fathers." Here it looks like filial reverence trumps even the demands of justice. More spectacular still is a tale found in the Mengzi about one of the great sage kings who was named Shun. When he became emperor, his family tried to assassinate him so that they could get their hands on his wealth. Yet Shun persevered in trying to gain the approval of his parents and refused to punish them or his murderous brother. Mengzi explains that a benevolent man never harbors anger or nurses a grudge against a brother. All he does is to love him. These conceptions of what filial piety requires of a person in relation to their parents persisted well beyond Mengzi's time. A historian, Xu Tongzu, shows that law in China incorporated the spirit of Confucian beliefs and calls this phenomenon the Confucianization of law. For example, the crime of not being filial was one of the 10 offenses in the codes during the Northern Qi period. This meant, for example, that children were not allowed to bring accusations against their parents. There was also a specific law relating to the mourning period. Because the mourning period was to last for 3 years, a person could be punished if they were to marry, become an official, or be entertained with music during this time. So, although Kongzi let Zai Wo off the hook, the law later on would not have done so. Even if you like the idea of filial reverence and all that should spring from it, this may seem to be taking a good idea too far. But let's not leap to conclusions, because the Confucians had more to say about this kind of case. They recommended a policy called remonstrance. This is found even in the Xiao Jing, or Classic of Filial Reverence, a dialogue in which Kongzi and an interlocutor explore the nature and demands of this ethical virtue. While one should, of course, never fail to show respect for one's parents, it is possible to remonstrate with them respectfully. The same would apply in the political context. Rather than simply obeying every wicked or foolish command of a bad ruler, a good minister should find every possible way to educate and enlighten the ruler. If that isn't possible because the ruler is too corrupt, one should do what Kongzi did when faced with the same situation, withdraw from public life. But remember, this does not mean giving up on politics. Merely by continuing to relate appropriately to family and friends, you are already doing your bit. And if you want to get more ambitious, you can always imitate Kongzi again by compiling some classic works on poetry and ritual, which would be a more effective way to spread righteousness than trying to reform an unreformable ruler. This moderate advice, offer constructive criticism without ever indulging in outright defiance, may strike some of us as insufficient. Don't some situations call for outright defiance? Not according to the Confucians. They seem to accept that within a hierarchical relationship, correct behavior will always presuppose respecting and maintaining the hierarchy. This may seem especially problematic in light of the aforementioned point that the relationships in question are often not chosen voluntarily. Here we come to another challenge that confronts Confucian role ethics. The modern-day ideal of individual autonomy is, it might be argued, precisely what has allowed us to escape from asymmetric power relations, in which certain people are expected to show deference to others simply because of the relationships they find themselves in, whether in the family or the political sphere. In short, hierarchy is fundamental to role ethics, and hierarchy is bad. But here, too, the defender of role ethics has moves to make in response. For starters, it's not as if all the responsibility is on the part of the son, wife, or subject. Let's take another look at that passage in which Mengzi sets out the 5 canonical relationships. He says that there should be affection between father and son, rightness between ruler and ruled, and between husband and wife, attention to their separate functions. Clearly, then, there are responsibilities on both sides. If parents fail to care for and show affection to their children, that would be a grave failing on their part, just as much as it would be if a child failed to respect and show affection to them. So when Emperor Shun continued to hold up his end of the relationship despite his family's misdeeds, he was right to do so. The fact that someone else behaves badly doesn't give you license to do the same. This point is also of vital importance in the case of the relationship between ruler and subject. Subjects must show obedience to their rulers, tempered by their role as advisors who may remonstrate as appropriate. But rulers must do their part too, by ruling in a just and righteous manner. Surprisingly, for anyone who thinks that unconditional respect for hierarchy is deeply embedded in Confucianism, a passage in the Mengzi strongly suggests that a sufficiently bad sovereign may lose his demand on the subject's obedience. Mengzi is asked about the last of the Shang rulers, Zhou, a notorious tyrant who was toppled and killed. He replies that this was just a case of punishing a criminal, not a true regicide. Here we have an illustration of how the procedure of rectification of names is carried out. Whereas Zhou bore the designation of king, he did not behave like a king, and therefore the title should be stripped from him. From Meng Zi's perspective, Zhou's behavior was fitting of criminals. Therefore, Meng Zi called him, and called him out, as a criminal. Although emphasizing roles can seem oppressive, as it binds people to their roles, on the other hand, it supports Meng Zi's very bold move to hold the former King Zhou to account. Furthermore, the defender of role ethics can point out that hierarchy is not, in fact, a pervasive feature of this approach. In the case of the parent-child relationship and the ruler-subject relationship, it makes no sense to complain about hierarchy, because hierarchy is definitive of these relationships. It would be a pretty radical proponent of individual autonomy who thinks that children owe no obedience to their parents or citizens to their governments. Hierarchy between siblings might look more controversial, but it is fairly plausible that younger brothers and sisters might look up to their older siblings while the older ones help to look after the younger ones. Again, specific responsibilities would be determined by individual factors like the difference in age between the siblings. More disturbing is the hierarchical understanding of marriage that is unarguably and unsurprisingly present in ancient Chinese Confucian texts. We'll return to the theme of gender in Confucianism in a later episode. For now, we can simply report that in their defense of the Confucian position, Rosemont and Ames admit the need to revise ancient attitudes on this relationship, but they believe that this can be done within the framework of role ethics, writing that we can and must strive to redefine gender difference in a way that replaces an oppressive inequality with a complementary and productive parity. Of particular interest in this context is the last of the five relationships between friend and friend. It seems to be the only one of the five that is not hierarchical, and in a society with arranged marriage, it would also be the only one that is subject to individual choice. In keeping with this, the attitude distinctive of friendship is trust, xin, which looks like it can and even should be equal on both sides. That is further supported by Kong Zi's advice, do not accept as a friend anyone who is not your equal, which might suggest that Kong Zi didn't have any friends. After all, who was his equal? Yet he says otherwise in the Analects, identifying as his three main aspirations, to bring comfort to the aged, to inspire trust in my friends, and be cherished by the youth. Again, we have here the idea that it is trust that characterizes good friendships, which might explain why friends need to be roughly equal, especially in moral terms. To trust a friend is to have confidence that they will not let you down through moral failure. A similar explanation is offered by Meng Zi, who says that since the purpose of friendship is to develop together in goodness, one should refuse to befriend those who are morally inferior. As the modern-day scholar Ci Fen Lu has put it, exemplary persons depend on the presence of other exemplary persons for their own moral development and the promotion of the highest good in society. The fact that Confucian friendships are premised on equality is important because it means that hierarchy is not always necessary for proper relationships. The role ethicist can say that it's an open question whether hierarchical order is appropriate in a given situation, and that the answer will depend on the role or relationship that is at stake. In turn, this means that we could disagree with ancient Confucian assumptions about hierarchy in a given case, for example, by rejecting the notion that wives should show deference toward their husbands, while accepting the broader framework of role ethics. Doing so could have far-reaching philosophical consequences. Rosemont and Ames think that role ethics is not just a way to understand people's moral attitudes and responsibilities, but should even prompt us to rethink what people are in the first place. They write that in Confucianism, a person is not a self, soul, mind, or will, but instead, the embodied social activity of thinking and feeling within the manifold of relations that constitutes family, community, and the natural environment. What it is to be you is just to be the child of your parents, the sibling of your siblings, the friend of your friends, and so on. This brings to mind an important aspect of relationships in Confucian philosophy, the idea of mutuality or reciprocity, shu, whereby two people in a relationship respond fittingly to the other. We saw in an earlier episode that shu is in fact the one word that guides Kong Zi through life. The idea of mutuality highlights the relation between two people. It has different characteristics according to the nature of the relationship. For example, mutuality between friends might involve one's challenging the other if there's something about them that is not right. In fact, Kong Zi says explicitly that we need to admonish our friends. By contrast, mutuality between father and son is not a relationship between equals. The father's benevolence towards the son must be appropriately matched by the son's filiality toward the father. Confucian roles are not aspects of our lives that we can shed as and when we like. They are formative of our identity. They make us who we are. If we were so unfortunate as to have a father like Shun's father, would that not shape our experiences and outlook on life? As one scholar has put it, for Confucius, unless there are at least two human beings, there are no human beings. This is a view central to Confucian thought. In fact, the belief that a person is essentially a related being is enfolded in the concept of Ren, benevolence, which we've already come across. This is a pretty radical idea, which should prompt us to do something else, have a closer look at conceptions of personhood and selfhood in early Confucianism, something we'll be doing relatively soon, namely next time here on the History of Philosophy in China.